Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Troy Halsell, and I'm your host on New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Gretchen Minton. She is a professor of English at Montana State University, and we are discussing her new book, Shakespeare in Montana, Big Sky Country's Love Affair with the World's Most Famous Writer, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Tracing more than two centuries of history, Shakespeare in Montana uncovers a vast array of different voices that capture the state's love affair with the world's most famous writer. From mountain men, pioneers, and itinerant acting companies and mining camps, to women's clubs at the turn of the century, and the contemporary popularity of Shakespeare in the parks throughout Montana, the book chronicles the stories of residents across this incredible western state who have been attracted to the words and works of Shakespeare. Minton explores this unique relationship found in the Treasure State and provides considerable insight into the myriad places and times in which Shakespeare's words have been heard and discussed. By revealing what Shakespeare has meant to the people of Montana, Minton offers us a better understanding of the state's citizens and history while providing a key perspective on Shakespeare's enduring global influence. Gretchen, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's just jump right into this thing. So the first question, and this is the one I always lead off with here, is how did you come to write this book?
Well, I am a Shakespeare scholar, so I'm a professor in an English department, and I publish a lot of things on Shakespeare. And when I got this job at Montana State University in 2006, I thought, well, I love the mountains. I'm glad I'm going to get to live in the Intermountain West, but I assume that my research on Shakespeare is always going to take me elsewhere, like back to the UK, to the British Library, to the Royal Shakespeare Company, like where Shakespeare is centered. However, it didn't take long of being out here to start to suspect that Montana had a unique relationship with Shakespeare. I noticed Montana Shakespeare in the Parks, a beloved cultural institution of this state right away, and thought, what a special organization that is. And then my husband, Kevin's, who is has a great knowledge of the American West, said, well, you know that the mountain men love Shakespeare, and they came out here reading Shakespeare. And I said, really? And then this got me thinking and wanting to research a little bit about what is the relationship between Shakespeare and Montana, and what has the reception been? And the more I got into this subject, the more fascinating it was. And so my coming to know and love this state in the 15 years I've lived here has really been parallel to researching and publishing this book.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah. That's fascinating. Cause I remember when I was just scouring the websites looking for books that might fit this, and I came across your book, and my reaction was, well, of course I'm going to do that one. But because it was something that I never thought or considered, you know, when I thought of quote unquote the West, just like we'll talk about quote unquote Shakespeare here in a second. And so I'm really glad that you tackled it because, As our listeners will come to hear as we get into it, you know, just the, I don't know if pervasive is the right word, but I mean, just how ever present Shakespeare was and is, just going back as far as you can probably document, at least in the written word, was something that actually fascinated me a good bit. And so I was really excited to read it. So kind of the first question, always, or not first question, the second one here. So what did the research process look like for this book? And I asked that question because yourself as a Shakespeare scholar and someone who does literary criticism wrote a history of Shakespeare in Montana. So I'm kind of curious how you as a literary scholar approached that kind of from a method standpoint or just, you know, where you got your stories essentially.
Mm-hmm. So it took about a decade, really, of work to bring this book together because I was also working on a lot of other things at the same time. And the research, though, was endlessly fascinating. So, and often, again, my husband was with me and we would drag our son and say, okay, we're taking another trip to the archives. And so some of it was physical trips to archives in the state, like Montana Historical Society in Helen, the Butte Silver Bow Archives, also some smaller places in Fort Benton and Lewistown and other places. So sometimes it's scouring through, you know, linear files that about various figures or opera houses in a community, a lot of material about women's reading groups that I spent time looking at in Helena and Butte in particular. Some of it had to do with interviewing people, people with Montana Shakespeare in the Parks. And I work with that company and know a lot of the artists, but also we trailed the company and saw the productions in different places and interviewed long-term audience members. And some of it came from newspapers.com, which is a tremendous archive where you can search. And these wonderful people have scanned decades of newspapers throughout the state. And so I can't imagine having been able to dig up some of the stories I did if I was looking through microfilm and trying to hope that I saw the name Shakespeare, right? So I could just type it in or type various actors' names in and they would come up on newspapers.com. So that was a treasure trove of information, as were the historical archives, but also that oral history of just talking to people, especially long-term Montana residents and saying, you know, did you go to a one-room schoolhouse? You know, did you learn Shakespeare? And people would say, oh, my grandmother taught Shakespeare at this place. Would you like to see these books? Or we'd be in Dillon and the librarian there would say, oh, here's a repository of books that belong to the women's club here. And so much of that word of mouth and oral history, as well as the written record in newspapers and women's clubs, just gave a really wide and deep knowledge of what Shakespeare has meant in this state.
You know, as a historian, I can definitely appreciate going to the archives and looking for that needle among needles. You know what I mean? Just because it's Shakespeare, it's just when you kind of zoom in on it, right? It's Shakespeare, then you go up a level, then maybe it's a particular theater house, and then up a bit more, it's theater, you know, live performances, and being able to pull Shakespeare and what his works meant to the residents of Montana. I mean, I was actually quite fascinated as I was digging through your footnotes and stuff and looking at, you know, all the archival sources that you're using. I'm like, man, that is, talk about stitching together something to try to tell a story from fragments here and there. To me, as a story, I was actually quite impressed by it. So good job.
Well, thank you. Actually, what you said just makes me want to just make another comment about sometimes what you find in the archives is not what you think you're going to find. And you're convinced, okay, in this folder, I'm going to find everything. And then you look through and say, no, nothing interesting here. But then you stumble upon things you weren't expecting to find. There was one especially exciting moment when we were in Virginia City in this little library. And we said, oh, you know, we're looking for the history of people and books about Shakespeare in Virginia City. And the librarian said, I don't know that there's anything in particular here that will be of interest to you. And she let us walk back through the vault and their little collection. And all of a sudden I looked down and there's this old binding on a book. And we pulled it out and looked, and it was 1802 edition of the collected works of Shakespeare. And she didn't know it was there. It wasn't cataloged in the library. And here we had in our hands a book that had probably been in Virginia City since the 1860s, and that someone had brought it there. And it was just this beautiful, tangible evidence about people reading Shakespeare in that region that we never expected to find.
And of course, thinking about it, you know, going back that far, just someone had to physically lug that book from St. Louis to Virginia City or wherever it might have, you know, wherever their starting point was. And that means that something probably that could have saved their life didn't go in their pack, you know what I mean? And so that someone brought, for whatever reason, Shakespeare with them definitely points to that interest, that importance for the works of Shakespeare, in this case early on, but of course throughout the life of the state.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And one way or another, people were always carrying Shakespeare out here.
Okay, so let's kind of get into my questions about the content of the book. And so I kind of shoehorned in one question on the front end that I was just curious about. So for anyone who's who does pick up a Gretchen's book, you'll find that I believe it's five key chapters with your intro and your conclusion, your standard stuff. But what she's done between every chapter, she has these interludes. And they are kind of shorter passages about just the stories of Shakespeare and its relationship to Montana and Montanans. So I'm curious, why are those interludes there? Because as I read them, they definitely stand out as here's this other episode of Shakespeare in Montana. But at the same time, they weren't quite threaded through the narrative of the core five chapters of your book. And I was wondering if you can just kind of explain what they are, why they're there, their role, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the idea of an interlude is a pretty historically grounded one in terms of drama, right? So often there were main acts that performers would do, and in between there would be some sort of an interlude, something that just kind of gave the audience a break, or maybe another way of putting it is a different way of looking at the same material. And as I had all the research in the various folders in front of me, the computer files as well as the physical files, there was a certain organization which is roughly chronological, but more importantly kind of groups things together, like education in one chapter, women's reading groups in another, and itinerant performers in another. But then there would be other material that I didn't have enough of it for an entire chapter. Like I knew I wanted to talk about cowboys, for instance, because everyone would want to know, oh, what's cowboy engagement with Shakespeare? But there were great anecdotes about cowboys, and they sort of related to some of the other chapters, but there was more to it than that. And I thought, let's give the audience of the book just a chance to think just in terms of cowboys, whether that was, you know, people in the 1890s near Livingston or Charlie Russell or even contemporary cowboy poets, things that would allow us a broader chronological sweep of certain subjects. And they're shorter and a little bit different. And I just thought that it would be a nice break and a nice way of just exposing a slightly different viewpoint that gives a fuller picture of Shakespearean stories.
No, thank you for that. I felt that was going to be the answer, but I had to ask just to be certain. So thanks for explaining that for us. Okay, so let's jump in. So in your introduction, the first paragraph, you give this vignette where you're, I forget where you were, but you're checking into a hotel and the desk.
He's
talking about Shakespeare. And you made this distinction, right? There is Shakespeare without quotation marks and then Shakespeare with quotation marks. And can you kind of differentiate between what you mean, the difference between Shakespeare and then this Shakespeare that you put in quotation marks for us?
Yeah, so the Shakespeare without quotation marks is the man himself, that is the playwright who was born in Stratford-upon-Avon and lived from 1564 to 1616. And I can get into this later too, but I get asked all the time, did Shakespeare really write those plays? And, you know, my answer is yes, absolutely. And I'll be prepared to argue with anyone who says otherwise. But there was an actual human being who wrote these plays and these poems, and so that is Shakespeare. However, over the last four centuries, Shakespeare, in quotation marks, I use to refer to not just the man, but his works and the cultural legacy that his works have come to represent. I mean, he has become so incredibly influential, not just in the English-speaking world, but across the globe. And so Shakespeare in quotation marks is all of the movies and the spin-offs and the editions and the classes and the cultural capital of Shakespeare. And so he in quotation marks, means far more than any individual human could have anticipated four centuries ago.
Sorry about that. The cat got on the keyboard there. No, thanks for that. Yeah, no, it's interesting having to really kind of tell that difference, right? Because it's clear in your book where I know it's talking about, you know, William Shakespeare, the person, right? That they're definitely talking about this canon that he created, plays. You know, you focus on the plays aspect too, but I imagine they're also reading all of his other works as well and stuff like that. So, so with that, let's jump into, kind of what Shakespeare meant. So what did Shakespeare mean, to the men on the Montana frontier?
Well, as I mentioned before, it was really those anecdotes about the mountain men in the mid-19th century that ignited my imagination. And in particular, the anecdotes about Jim Bridger, of which there are dozens. And they all involve this unlikely meeting between an illiterate mountain man, such as Jim Bridger, and the works of Shakespeare. But he apparently loved to have people read Shakespeare to him. He had a lot of opinions about Shakespeare's stories, sometimes was outraged at the way it was going. One of those favorite anecdotes that I always tell is when he was incensed that Shakespeare wrote that Richard III killed his nephews, the princes, in the Tower of London. And so Bridger threw the book into the fire, outraged. But then he got another one because he wanted to keep reading Shakespeare. I mean, some of these stories, we can't possibly know how embellished they are, how many are tall tales. One of the points I make in the book is, even if they are tall tales, the fact that people were interested in telling those stories is in and of itself a story. Like, why is it that people kept wanting to talk about Shakespeare on the frontier? But I think that what we do know for sure is that the two books that consistently show up with the mountain men and the pioneers is the King James Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And because the King James Bible was published in 1611, that is a book that is contemporary to Shakespeare. So I think the mountain men liked the way the words of Shakespeare sounded. They sounded kind of like the Bible as an early 17th century language. And I think that Shakespeare for these mountain men was a source of wisdom, a source of poetry, but also just some good storytelling that could help them pass some really boring times on the frontier. I think that, you know, sometimes we have this imagination that it was all excitement and fighting off grizzly bears and protecting yourselves from invasions and things like that. But what's evident from reading the historical record is how much time there was just waiting around. Like Osborne Russell talking about the gathering with his fellow trappers in these huts through the long winter nights, and they're cold and they're bored and they have to have something to do. So they start reading Shakespeare to one another and talking about the stories. And the same thing happened on army forts on the frontiers as well, where people start passing the time by reading and then eventually acting. And then they identify with various characters and situations. And because Shakespeare's works are so expansive, whether you want to think about war or whether you want to think about love or troubled relationships between parents and children or any number of things, it's all in Shakespeare, right? So he tells a good story. He tells it with beautiful language that I think that people are drawn to and in complex ways that give you a lot of opportunity to have discussions and debates and get on your feet and do some acting. And I think for all of those reasons, the men on the frontier were attracted to these stories.
I really like how you pointed to like there's a lot of downtime. There's something to do, and it just made me think that anytime I see a Western movie or even Charlie Russell's artwork here in Great Falls, right? You know, you always see guys playing cards, right? And I'm always, you know, at first I was like, well, why are they always playing cards? I was like, well, what else are they gonna do? You know what I mean? They've got so much downtime. So it makes sense to me, at least, that that, you know, if it's not cards, it's Shakespeare, it's something else. And so being able to kind of come together and pass time. I'm sure there's a bonding element if they're going through and passing around one of the plays that everybody's reading lines from. And I can just kind of picture how that really draws people in, both to the works, but also just the people that they might be with. And of course, that's just pure speculation on my end, but that's kind of how, when I go camping, that's what I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. to me too.
Okay, so let's move on just a bit. So who played a role in creating what you call the Golden Age of Shakespeare in Montana?
When I saw that question, I had a little preview of that question. I was thinking, out of all the people that I could choose, who am I going to say? But to pick one representative example, I think I'm going to just throw out the name Daniel Bandman. Because Daniel Bandman is a very fascinating character. He was an actor who was German-born, but he toured all over the world. I mean, literally, he went all throughout Europe and North America and went to Asia. But he fell in love with Montana. And he decided that he was going to give up the life of an actor and become a rancher in Montana. And against the odds, he actually did that. He bought a ranch outside of Missoula. And he ended up, having cattle and raising Macintosh apples and other curious things. But what's so fun about the stories of him is that here you have an incredibly talented European actor who thinks about how he played Shylock all these years, and he's going to give up Shylock and be a ranchman. And that double identity between Montana ranchman and Shakespearean actor follows him throughout his life. The newspapers can't get enough of him. They keep talking about how quirky he was and what did he do now. He was challenging people to see who could get up to the top of mountains more quickly. And he was challenging other actors to sword fights in the street and all this sort of thing. So he was a larger than life character who kept acting, whether he was on the stage or on the metaphorical stage of Montana. And so because he played in all these playhouses and spanned this this time period of the late 19th and early 20th century and put down roots in Montana, I see him really as emblematic of this change where Shakespeare is no longer just about itinerants who travel through Montana and just say, let me grace you with my beautiful performance of Hamlet and then move on. But he actually did settle here and was informed all of his subsequent appearances by his life in Montana. So when I think about who might represent the Golden Age, as I call it, I think that he's a pretty good example.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, his stories were the picture you painted of him was something where it was both hard for me to believe, even though I reread many paragraphs from that particular section, but you kind of made a point, right? Or you said something made me think that, like, for him, the curtain was always up, that he was mm-hmm. always performing either Shakespeare or whatever this Daniel Bandman persona was from that. And so I know that he settled, but either, I don't know if this is a before he settled or after he settled, but let's go with it, like, after he actually planted some roots here. I mean, did he continue to go on a circuit and perform for folks throughout Montana during this time period, or was that kind of more on the front end of his time here, and then kind of on the back half, he properly became a rancher and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he as he got older, he acted less and less, but he would occasionally go back to New York to act, but he did also go to Butte periodically and some other places. And then he and his wife ended up acting periodically in Missoula, and they helped to found the Montana Maskers, which is a long-term theater troupe at the University of Montana. And his wife, and this is another funny story about him, is it was a young actress who came out to kind of take lessons from Daniel Bandman, as it were. And then there was a big scandal when she ended up pregnant. But she became an impressive actor in her own right and was in some films as well. And so I think the way you put it is a really good way, is that the curtain was always up and he was always acting in one way or another. Like, one of the anecdotes that happens quite late in his life is that there was another theater troupe who came through and they acted, and there was this surly looking guy in the front row, and they couldn't figure out who it was. And then afterwards, they realized that Daniel Bandman himself had been watching them play. And then they were honored and excited. But it's like he was still this persona of, now I'm going to be the guy in the front row, and everybody's going to notice me more than they're going to notice these people on stage who are pouring their heart and soul out to this drama.
Like, he was upstage in the performance from the first row. I find that very, very funny. Mm-hmm. Okay, so next question here. So talk about big names. Lost my train of thought here. Where's it at? Oh yeah. So moving away from men as some characters into women here. What was the relationship between women and Shakespeare in that late 19th, early 20th century?
Well, the clearest relationship is from the women's reading groups that I have already mentioned. And this movement in the late 19th and early 20th century of women's reading groups happens all over the U.S. But it becomes especially important to the development of women's communities, in the 1890s and into the 19-teens. And so women in places like Butte and Dillon and Helena and Great Falls and all over the place would get together in drawing rooms, and every week or two, they would have a group that had a real curriculum. So it was a rigorous curriculum. It would go through all of the plays of Shakespeare and Greco-Roman history and mythology, and they were really learned. And so the women would read, they would present papers to one another, they would give elocution lessons. Apparently certain fines if they didn't show up and do their homework. And then many of them actually performed as well. And so the cultural import of these organizations, I think, is quite clear in these communities as these women, moved into places that during the time of white settlement were largely male communities. And these women said, okay, we're going to bring culture, and we're not going to let anybody think that we're unlearned, uncouth people just because we happen to live out here in the West. And so the rigor and the articulateness of these groups really does shine through in the programs, in the entertainments these women gave, in these full-fledged performances. And also they would invite lecturers from the East Coast and from other places all over the U.S. to come and give a lecture to them, and then they would sponsor these. And it was really such a remarkable thing to go through the minutes books and the programs of these groups and to realize just how invested these women were in the study of Shakespeare and what he meant, especially the wisdom that he could give them when it came to Shakespeare's outspoken female characters. Like, they loved talking about these great women, such as Rosalind from As You Like It, Portia from Merchant of Venice, Beatrice from Much Ado About Nothing. Like, these are some powerful, articulate, bossy women. And the women of the early 20th century reading groups loved talking about these women. And these are the same women who were invested in the suffrage movement. And often these things ran in parallel, and you could see women discussing and getting excited about My Lady Tongue, which is this great way of referring to Beatrice, and Jeanette Rankin. Right? And it's like, we have a voice and we deserve the right to vote. And I love this idea that they were co-opting Shakespeare for very immediate political needs for them at the beginning of the 20th century.
I can't remember if you said it explicitly in the book or not, but it also feels like, you know, them moving into, and Butte might be a great example, right? Where it's, I'm making a number up, but if they're at the time there's 50,000 people, there might be 49,000 men, you know, in the town. And so it felt like for me that these clubs that they developed around Shakespeare was also a way to kind of create just a kind of a female community in these very, very male dominated spaces. And then from there, as you point out, it turns into not only just kind of this education program, not only this way to show, hey, we may live in Butte, but we're still cultured, right? But it keeps pushing forward into suffrage and other topics like that. Okay, so lost my train of thought here. Where is it at? Oh, yeah. So up to this point, so up to the early 20th century here, Shakespeare clearly has meant something for residents of Montana, whether on the frontier, mining camps. Now we have female women's clubs around Shakespeare. But how did Montanans keep his works alive for future generations? So there's clearly a foundation laid, right? But like, what was kind of the method to kind of keep people interested in it going forward?
The best way to keep Shakespeare alive for future generations, I figure, is always the schoolhouse. So, you know, most of us first encountered Shakespeare, sometime to our dismay, in school, right? My students say this all the time. Yes, I had to read Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade, and I'm still recovering from it. I of course, try to make them much more excited and positive about Shakespeare. But I think that what we see in this whole history of Shakespeare in Montana schoolhouses is that from a very early time, teachers see how exciting Shakespeare can be for the students, especially if you get students on their feet acting. And, you know, it's pretty common all over the U.S. In the 19th and 20th century to use the McGuffey readers to teach elocution, to teach poetry, to teach Shakespeare wisdom or morality or whatever people perceived it to be. But I think that in Montana, there's a lot of evidence that teachers thought it was important to get students performing Shakespeare and doing it early on. I was astounded at the number of eighth graders who were performing Merchant of Venice, like the whole play, like in, 1907, 1908. And then they were doing a spoof of the Merchant of Venice called the Merchant of Venice Up to Date, which is a spoof based on the idea that the play takes place in a high school football team and controversy that arises around that. And that is a tradition that continued, I think, through a lot of the one-room schoolhouses and then into even some contemporary Children's Shakespeare Society here in Bozeman or the Belt Valley Shakespeare Players up there near Great Falls, where teachers realized that if you give students some costumes and some creativity and you let them embody another character, that they can make their own sense out of Shakespeare and what these stories mean to them. Like they can switch the setting into something that makes sense to them. Like if it's Shakespeare in chaps, as it were, or if it's Shakespeare in a different time period or in their imaginations, letting students have that free rein with Shakespeare while also grounding it in the language is a story that I've seen across certainly the last century or so of Montana education. And this is something that I think that Ivan Doig's novels capture really well, is showing, schoolhouses or Butte or bar rooms where Shakespeare is important in the stories of Doig as well. Because he also, being a Montanan, understood the importance of Shakespeare to kids and their imaginations as they grow up and encounter this as part of their schooling.
And it had me thinking, talking about Ivan Doig. I read Bartender's Tale a few months back, and it's the only Ivan Doig book I've read. It was fascinating. I loved it. You know, it's one of those that's great for anybody of any age. But even that one, I think it wasn't the bartender, I forget his name, son, him and his friend had to go teach the newspaper man's wife or work with her through a script. I think it was Shakespeare. I can't really remember off the top of my head, but
yeah, they were actually working on Oscar. I think it was Oscar Wilde.
That's right.
But you're exactly right though, mm-hmm. that the kids in that book do fall in love with Shakespeare, and they go to a performance of As You Like It that comes through town, and then they fall in love and they decide they're going to become actors. And those are the types of stories that seem utterly believable, because this is the kind of thing that happens in every little town in Montana, is that this access to and interest in Shakespeare.
You know, and I'm just kind of reflecting back on my own experience with Shakespeare. And mine was probably like you let off is it was in high school, and I was like, ah, Romeo and Juliet, this is so dumb, you know, and that was kind of a reaction. And while I never actually got up and kind of read the lines and even just kind of walked through it, even for me, I've seen one Shakespeare play. This was in Memphis, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And it was one of the histories. I forget which one it was. I was in that theater for probably a better part of 3 hours, and I was on the edge of my seat the entire time, completely enthralled by what I was watching. Both the story, the performance. I was just amazed that you have a company of 10 actors playing 30 characters or whatever it might be. You know, just, you know, here's a guy who's a farmer, then he puts on the hat, now he's a soldier, and then it's a whole other set of lines. And so, like, I just got sucked into it. It was like, yeah, I mean, it's just a way to really draw people in that I find absolutely fascinating. So talking about, you know, drawing people in and kind of more contemporary. So two things here, right? Is can you just give our listeners just an overview about Montana Shakespeare and the Parks as a program, but specifically what you led the book off about is the experience at Poker Jim Butte in that particular performance. Cause I was absolutely fascinated by that story, but it really hammers home what that program does for Shakespeare and really just kind of anything cultural related in Montana up to present day.
Mm-hmm. So Montana Shakespeare in the Parks is about to celebrate its 50th year anniversary next year in 2022. So, you know, if you think about it, so it starts in the early 70s, and it is an outgrowth of what I was just talking about. And that is that sense that educational systems do carry on the love of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare in the Parks is housed at Montana State University. However, its mission is to go out and reach communities all over Montana and now a surrounding five-state area, with a special emphasis upon rural and underserved communities. And this is what makes the company so wonderful, is that you have professional actors who will go out and show up in tiny towns all over this region and give residents the opportunity to see for free a Shakespeare play, where in many cases, this is the only cultural event of the town. And it's certainly people's only chance to see theater. And because it's been going on now for so many decades, you have generations of people now who are continuing to sponsor the shows and, you know, do potlucks for the actors afterwards. And there's a real sense of community around the performance of Shakespeare and bringing people together to enjoy these stories together. One of the things that was so traumatic to these communities in 2020 is, for the first time in its history, Shakespeare in the Parks could not come because of COVID. And it wasn't just losing the opportunity to see Shakespeare or to have some cultural outlets. It was losing the opportunity to come together and experience those stories and the unfolding of the drama together. And what you mentioned, the location at Poker Jim Butte, so that's outside of the tiny town of Burney, which is in southeast Montana, very close to the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation. And for all of the years but one of its inception, Montana Shakespeare in the Parks has gone there to a place with, you know, almost no population, right? The town of Burney has about 16 people in it. Yet they draw about 100 people per performance every year who drive up to a state park at the top of a butte because they want to hear Shakespeare and experience this event together. And it is a beautiful place, and it is a fascinating community and culture of ranchers who live in an incredibly remote place. And again, the telling of Shakespeare year after year, and the children who go and see these plays, who are like you on the edge of their seats, or in this case, like the edge of their picnic blankets. And then these kids have grown up to with the actors and get to know the stories and get to know the actors who come back repeatedly. And it forms that sense of shared storytelling and experience on our land and with our families and with stories that mean a lot to all of us. And so I like to begin with Pokridge and Butte, because every time people hear about that location and that story, they want to know more. So like the New York Times has done a story on it, as has ABC and PBS. I mean, it's a thing that people can't help but talk about and want to partake in. And that's really the beauty of it, right?
I mean, it's the same thing with me, is as I'm sitting here reading about Pokridge and Butte and just how remote of a place that is to put on a play. I go on their website. I was like, when are they doing Pokridge and Butte? I'm going to drive out there and go watch them. But the Shakespeare in the Park, but you know, just like you said, the Pokridge and Butte example really, I think, draws home, like, you know, how magnetic Shakespeare in quotations marks, right, is for folks here in Montana. And then I'm assuming too, hopefully too, all the surrounding states that they do go do performances in. And even for me, I remember I moved up here in the summer of 2018, and summer of 2019, I forget exactly how it was. I was driving somewhere by Gibson Park in Great Falls, and I knew Shakespeare in a Park was a thing. And I look over, and there's a trailer with a small stage, and there's 100 people watching it, and I'm sitting there going, I'm like, I'll catch it next year. And then of course next year is 2020. So it's definitely on my to-do list, hopefully for next summer, to go check out one of those performances, either here locally or, well, maybe at Pokridge and Butte, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, and as I said, it is the 50th year anniversary of the company. So it will be an especially celebratory year to see the shows.
Okay. So let's start wrapping it up here. You've already demonstrated it, but if you could as well, could you try to just explain or tell our readers how your book, Shakespeare in Montana, helps us better understand the American West?
I think that one thing I kept coming back to as I was putting this all together and stitching it together, as you mentioned early on, is to, like, what story does all this Shakespeare encounter and schooling and reading groups and stages and gold rushes, like, what story does this tell about our region and about the history of the American West? And what I kept coming back to is that Montana is an incredibly large state with an incredibly big history, right? As big as our big skies. And Shakespeare is also the most expansive of authors. So because Shakespeare is so popular and so versatile and can really expand to mean what people need him to mean in different places and speak to people's needs and desires and fears and tragedies and traumas and all of that, I think that understanding Montana through the lens of Shakespeare helps us realize that the history of Montana is very large and a lot more diverse than I think a lot of people give it credit for, because it's not just a story of mountain men and cowboys and a bunch of white people running across the state, right? It also is a story, as we've been talking about, the women's reading groups and the attempt to establish certain culture. And it's also the story of teachers in one-room schoolhouses or other larger schoolhouses figuring out the best way to impart knowledge to their children. But it's also a story of some marginalized communities that I do talk about in one of the interludes in particular, when I have an interlude called From the Margins. and where I talk about the engagement of African-American communities with Shakespeare. I try to talk about the presence and also too often the silencing of Native American voices when it comes to encounters with Shakespeare. But whether we're talking about Native American communities or African American communities or women or people who are economically marginalized, those stories are very present in Montana's history too. And to see those communities and individuals engaging with Shakespeare on their own terms and saying, okay, if I'm going to, again, put on the costume of a reader or of an actor or of a speaker or of an activist, this is what Shakespeare means to me. I think that because Shakespeare is ever present in Montana, to look at the different ways that Montana residents have engaged with him is to listen to a different type of history, to listen to the soft voices as well as those booming loud bandman type voices. And I think that Shakespeare gives us that opportunity to not only look wide across the big sky, but to look in depth and for the more textured, subtle ways that people can open a book or attend a theater and have access to a story that can mean different things to different people at all times.
Yeah, I like how you put it, that you can project upon Shakespeare whatever it is you're going through. You know, and I think that's something that you've hinted at, or if not said explicitly throughout the book, is that there's a Shakespeare out there for everybody. And I'll even say too that after reading this book, I'm more likely to have a very long car ride drive ahead of me, and I'm already trying to find plays on podcasts for me to listen to as I go across the states and go, how does Hamlet apply to a 10-hour drive to North Dakota? I'm sure there's something in there for me somewhere.
More than you can imagine.
All right, so last question here. So what's next for you? What are you working on right now, if anything?
Oh, too many things. I'm always working on about five projects at once. One thing that I haven't started working on explicitly as much as thinking about is there's a lot of theater in Montana from you know the time of Virginia City on up through now. And Kevin and I have talked a little bit about getting together a book that's about theater in Montana, more broadly speaking, that's not just about Shakespeare. And then other things that I'm working on more insistently right now have to do with ways of adapting Shakespeare plays to speak to environmental crises locally in Montana. And I did an adaptation like that a couple years ago called Timon of Anaconda, set in Butte and talking about mining industry and environmental problems, and applying it, you know, with a Shakespeare play in the background. And I'm working on a couple of other plays along those same lines, because I think that, again, using Shakespeare to speak to urgent concerns is a really important way that we can think creatively and ethically and communally together. So that kind of work is really exciting me right now.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And we'll definitely keep I specifically keep my eyes peeled on your theater project, because I got something like that cooking in my head too. And I'll tell you about that after I hit stop record. But well, Gretchen, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. This was a fascinating discussion, and hopefully this will get folks to buy your book, because that's why we do these podcasts, but also think a bit more about Shakespeare in their daily lives.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks. Goodbye. Bye.